Les colloques du Collège de France.
It's so inspiring to be here with you all this week and to be surrounded by this level of science. It's especially inspiring to be able to celebrate, and an honor to be able to celebrate Stan, who we've seen, his discoveries have just been foundational to opening up so many areas of cognitive science, as we've seen in the talks of the last 2 days and we'll see more of tomorrow. And so maybe this is an opportunity to reflect a little bit on the underlying traits that make this kind of fantastic discovery possible. And I think that all of us can agree that Stan is a paragon example of a person whose fundamental curiosity about all different aspects of the natural world has led us into so many interesting places, right? So it's this trait of curiosity that's, I get present in all of us to some degree that propels us to try to understand the objects and the people and the numbers around us. And of course, for those of us in this room today, to understand our own minds. So how should we think about this force that empowers this kind of discovery? Well, we can think of curiosity, it's a drive for information, but more specifically, it's a drive for understanding that happens in the absence of a clear reward, right? So we, as humans, get some kind of unique satisfaction out of building new causal understandings, even when those causal understandings are not a means to some other end. And you know, you can think of, like, that's why even non-scientists go to science museums, right? There's no obvious benefit in coming to understand the stars above us or coming to understand creatures that have been extinct for millions of years, but we just have this drive to know that's present within all of us. And famously, this drive is present within children, right? We think of children as curious. Moreover, there's a wealth of research that suggests that curiosity has beneficial effects, right? It improves memory retention. It leads to more efficient learning. It's associated with better long-term academic achievement. And therefore, it's no wonder that a lot of effort has gone into trying to figure out ways to foster and promote curiosity. We try to bring curiosity into school curricula or help teachers scaffold curiosity, even at the like college and university level. But maybe all of this focus on ways to stimulate curiosity in children and in adolescents skirts the question a bit of where curiosity comes from in the first place. And this emphasis on how to promote it might seduce us into thinking about curiosity as something that requires kind of like fancy cognition. Maybe it requires metacognition. Maybe it requires awareness. Maybe it rests on explicit training. And so in today's talk, I want to try to paint a different picture, one in which curiosity might be a virtue of our human minds from our very earliest days. Okay, so why should we think that? What evidence is there? We're going to need evidence that's more than just like babies are motivated to orient towards certain aspects of their world. We're going to want to see that they actually show a drive for understanding, and maybe more. Maybe we're going to want to see that this is a trait that persists over long periods of time, or maybe that's associated with aspects of learning. So as a starting point, we can look at the field of cognitive development, specifically infant cognition, and the very beautiful work of people in this room, including Liz Spelke, that's taught us that from just barely a few months of life, babies represent aspects of the world around them. For example, they represent objects. And they don't. The objects that you commonly populate are in babies' experience. They not only perceive these objects, but they have expectations about how they behave. And importantly, we know about these expectations because of the spontaneous patterns of looking that babies exhibit. So, for example, we know that babies expect objects to be solid because those babies look longer when an object appears to pass straight through something, like a barrier in its path, compared to if the object is stopped by the barrier. Or just to pick one other little example, we know that babies expect that objects require support or else they'll fall because babies look longer when objects appear to float in midair compared to when they're supported by something underneath. So these are just a couple of examples from the field, but I think the question is, does this longer looking actually reflect something about curiosity? Are babies looking longer in these cases because they're trying to like understand these puzzling aspects of their world? A reason to maybe be a little bit cautious in attributing this kind of capacity for understanding curiosity to these babies is that these kind of expectations about objects are not just present in young humans, they're also present in lots of other animal species, like this newly hatched chick you see here on the upper right. In addition, patterns of like longer elevated visual interest, longer looking, are shown not just by babies, but also by a range of other species. Here it's been shown, for example, in dogs and in rooks. And this widespread nature of the behavior is really interesting. It could tell us something about the expectations, but it does raise the possibility that the behavior itself of longer looking is maybe something simpler, more rigid, more reflexive, something more like, you know, a freezing response that may not be geared toward furthering understanding. So babies longer looking to violations of expectations may not really be epistemic in nature. And so in the rest of my time today, I want to quickly consider four questions and give you a little taste of how my lab's been trying to answer those questions. Overall, the overarching goal is to try to figure out whether babies experience something like what we experience, genuine epistemic curiosity. So I'm going to quickly ask whether surprising events amplify babies' drive to explore, whether exploration is in service of finding explanations for puzzling stuff, whether there are individual differences in this trait that last over time, and whether those individual differences, if we find them, are linked to anything interesting about later capacities. Okay, so we can start with the highly, highly informal observation that, like, the behavior you see babies doing could be described as curiosity-driven. Certainly, this baby is exploring her own environment, she's producing actions, is it fair to call her curious? Or maybe she's something more simple like novelty seeking. So to be able to try to pull these things apart, we need to bring the behavior of this baby into the laboratory. And that's what my former graduate student Amy Stahl did. So to find out if babies are specifically motivated to explore in situations where there's really something to learn, where you really should be revising your causal understanding of the world, Amy tested a bunch of 11-month-olds, and she showed babies live, in-person events that are based on the ones I told you about earlier. So half of the babies in this study saw a solidity event that either culminated in an expected outcome where the object is stopped by a wall in its path, or an unexpected outcome in which it's revealed to have somehow magically passed through the wall. And then half of the babies in this study saw expected or unexpected versions of a support event where the surprising version was an object's pushed off a box and it floats in midair. Okay, so Amy showed babies one of these four events, and then gave babies on their high chair tray those objects to explore. So one of those was the object they'd just seen do something totally expected or cool and surprising, and one was a completely novel, never before seen distractor object. And so then Amy plotted babies' spontaneous engagement with these things. And you can see here, what I'm going to show you is babies' exploration preference score, where if they prefer to play with the thing they just saw, that's going to be over on the right, and the other direction to the left is preferring the novel thing, and in the middle is no preference. And so first we can look at the exploratory behavior of the babies who saw the expected version, where an object is stopped by a wall. Those babies had no interest in that object. They spend all of their time looking at the novel distractor, right? But for babies who saw the almost identical event with the object just winding up on the other side of the wall, a couple inches over to the side, babies reversed that novelty preference and spent almost all of their time playing with the object that had just defied the principle of solidity. And the same basic pattern was seen for the babies who see the two different versions of the support event. Okay, so you might wonder, like, what babies are actually looking for? What are they trying to learn during these exploratory bouts? And we reasoned that maybe if we take a finer-grained approach to looking at the behaviors that they produced all on their own, we could start to get an answer to that question. And we noticed that babies produce a lot of behaviors, but two of them emerged in particular. One is that babies tended to bang objects with their hand or against the surface of the little high chair tray. Another behavior that was very common is dropping objects. So babies would pick the object up and release it so that it fell on the tray, or they would pitch it over the side of the table. These are actually two different babies playing with the same object. What's critical is that these babies had just seen, both seen a magical event, but two different versions. So the baby who did all of that object banging had just seen a ball appear to go through a wall. The baby who had just did all of that object dropping had just seen an object float in midair. And we can ask whether these two particular individual babies are representative of the whole group by plotting babies' Z-scored action tendencies. So more tending to produce more banging is on the right, tending to produce more dropping is on the left. Here you see the behaviors of the babies who saw the expected versions, and they don't tend to produce more of one than the other, and both of those at pretty low levels. But critically, when you see the babies who saw the magical version of those events, those exploratory behaviors really pull apart. And so the babies who saw the solidity violation do more banging, and the other babies do more dropping. Notice how this really moves us, I think, away from the interpretation that babies' responses to surprising events are rigid or reflexive. What babies are doing here is spontaneously producing targeted exploratory actions on the objects that defied their expectations. And those data, Amy's data, looked an awful lot like hypothesis testing, or something related to us, right? Like, babies may be seeking an explanation for why these objects behaved magically, and then they're producing behaviors that will produce relevant data toward testing those hypotheses or toward finding those explanations. But there's also a less interesting interpretation of the results, which is that maybe babies just wanted to reproduce the magic trick, okay? And so I think here we have an interesting prediction. If babies are actually producing that exploratory behavior because they're looking for an explanation, then if we give them an explanation, all of that rich exploratory behavior should just go away. And so that was a hypothesis tested by a former graduate student of mine, Jasmine Perez. And here's the data from the babies who saw the original versions of the events. And Jasmine shows them a solidity event too. This is a car that's going to go through a wall. We know babies are surprised at that. We know they want to explore the object. But then Jasmine just does the subtle trick of rotating the wall to reveal it had a hole in it, thereby offering babies a plausible explanation for why that happened. And among those babies who saw that exploratory evidence, indeed, their exploratory drive is abolished. They're no longer interested in that object. And that is not because rotating the wall made them like forget about what happened. If you rotate the wall to reveal non-explanatory information, it's solid, then those babies show that robust drive for exploration. Okay. So I think this provides pretty compelling evidence that these pre-verbal babies are seeking and recognizing explanations for surprising events. So far in this talk, I've been kind of considering curiosity as like a state that infants enter into upon trying, you know, being puzzled by some aspect of the world. But some researchers think of curiosity not just as an attentional or an affective state, but also as a trait. So we can think about some people in our own lives who seem really curious, who have like this strong need for cognition, drive for understanding, and who maybe demonstrate an early drive that persists over longitudinal time. And so I want to ask then whether we see any evidence for this in infancy. Are some babies more curious than others over the long term? And we have a little bit of data to start to address that question at least. So typically baby experiments present group data collected at one time point. In another experiment, Jasmine instead took a longitudinal approach to look at individual differences among babies. So first she brings babies in and shows them live, when they were 11 months, a solidity event that's either magical or surprising. And then to find out whether they're, and she measures their looking time at those outcomes. And then to find out whether their looking at 11 months predicts anything about their behavior later on, she brings those same babies back into the lab 6 months later and shows them a totally unrelated gravity event with a different object. And Jasmine found that those babies who are the most interested in the magical solidity event when they were 11 months are the same babies who are most interested in the magical support event at 17 months. And that's not because those babies are just the babies with, you know, that's not reflecting something about their attention span. Because among babies who saw the expected versions, there's no longitudinal relationship. Okay, so this is something specific about your interest when in trying to find out when something, why something strange happened. And this was sort of, at least to our knowledge, the first discovery that there are these like individual differences in infants' responses to expectancy violations that could reflect individual differences in curiosity, or it could reflect something different. For example, maybe what Jasmine was picking out was something more like the babies who cared more about objects, like the babies with a better intuitive physics engine, like the one that Nancy spoke about yesterday. And so this question is something that my current grad student, Nick Bisbee, has been working on. What Nick did is to show babies the same kind of possible and impossible events I showed you earlier. These babies saw solidity events and support events. They also, the same baby, saw two other events from the domain of physical cognition. They saw continuity events and containment events, both expected and surprising versions. Critically, Nick also tested these same babies' responses to four different kinds of social events. So some of you know that not only do infants have expectations about how like physical objects behave, they also have expectations about how the entities in their social world behave, and those seem to be supported by a different system instantiated in different regions of the brain and operating on the basis of different principles. So for example, babies expect people to reach directly for objects that are their goals as opposed to circuitously. That's just one example, one of the social events Nick showed babies. So Nick showed these, every one of these babies in this experiment 16 different events, four physical, four social, crossing with expected and unexpected. And so what Nick's interested in is whether there's any coherence in infants' responses. In particular, whether their surprise responses, so the extent to which they looked longer at the magical versions compared to the expected versions, are better fit by two separate factors, one for physical reasoning and one for social reasoning, or instead by a single general factor. And what Nick found was that the single factor curiosity model provided a better fit. Here's just a different way to see that, is to look at the surprise responses of individual babies. There's average surprise response for the four physical events on the X and the social events on the Y. And clearly it's the case that babies' interest in the event, one to the other, is predicted. Even when you account for overall length of looking time, This effect survives. So I should just note quickly that I think these results certainly don't deny that object physics and social reasoning are separate domains. I think we have really beautiful evidence for that. But rather, maybe Nick's results suggest that the error signals that are generated by the representations when the expectations by these domains conflict with observations of the world might feed into some shared mechanism that guides the observer to do further exploration. Okay, one last result. The last question is whether these individual differences I've shown you actually reflect something about curiosity writ large, or is this some specific bespoke thing about infancy? If these infant measures predict curiosity, then babies' behavior should correlate, predict later outcomes, more canonical measures of the kind used with older children. And so both Jasmine and Nick ask this by following their babies up later, a couple months or years later. Here's Jasmine's data. She asked parents to fill out this curiosity questionnaire where they rated whether they agreed with statements like, my child is bothered when he doesn't understand something and he tries to make sense of it. They also rated non-curiosity relevant items. And Jasmine found that the interest that babies demonstrated at 17 months old when a ball passed through, when an object floated in midair, predicted their parental ratings of their curiosity scores. And the same effect holds in Nick's data. These are babies' average greater interest in the surprising versions of the event across all eight events also predicted parental ratings of curiosity. Okay, so that's just a start. There's much more left to do. But I just returned to where I started. I tried to offer you four pieces of evidence that babies indeed experience genuine epistemic curiosity. Like adults, babies want to explore surprising things. Like adults, this exploration is in the service of finding explanations for building new understandings of the world. Babies seem to differ one to the other in how much they express this trait, and this predicts broad measures of curiosity much later in time. And that suggests that the curiosity that guides our experience of the world is present in our earliest days of life, making so much of our human experience possible, including the very science that we're all here to celebrate today. And so with that, I thank you for your attention. I thank you, Stan, and thanks to the people who did this work.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.